Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for standing by. Welcome to Artisan Partners Asset Management's fourth quarter 2013 earnings conference call. My name is Emily, and I will be your conference operator today. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. After the prepared remarks, management will conduct a question-and-answer session, and conference participants will be given instructions at that time. As a reminder, this conference call is being recorded. At this time, I will turn the call over to Makela Taphorn with Artisan Partners. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. Before we begin, I would like to remind you that our fourth quarter earnings release and the related presentation materials are available on our investor relations section of our website. I would also like to remind you that comments made on today's call and some of the responses to your questions may deal with forward-looking statements and are subject to risks and uncertainties. Factors that may cause our actual results to differ from expectations are presented in the earnings release and are detailed in our filings with the SEC. We undertake no obligation to revise these statements following the date of this conference call. In addition, some of the remarks this morning include references to non-GAAP financial measures. You can find reconciliations of those measures to the most comparable GAAP measures in the earnings release and exhibits. Finally, as you may have seen, we have filed an initial registration statement for the follow-on offering we agreed to conduct on behalf of our limited partners on or about the first anniversary of our initial public offering. We cannot discuss the offering on this call, so please refer to the documents on file with the SEC if you would like more information. With that, I'll now turn the call over to our Chief Executive Officer, Eric Colson.
Thank you, Makela. Welcome to the Artisan Partners Asset Management business update and quarterly earnings call. I'm Eric Colson, CEO, and I'm joined today by C.J. Daley, CFO. Thank you for your time today. I hope you find this discussion useful. Like our first three updates, I want to spend time reinforcing our business strategy. Given that this quarter concludes our first calendar year as a public company, I also want to spend some time framing the year in the context of our strategy. Key areas of emphasis for me will be the integrity of our investment results, the quality of our investment franchises and development of investment teams, the alignment of interest with our clients and professional talent, and the health of our asset base. Once I'm done, C.J. will take the lead walking through our financials before I conclude with some thoughts about the outlook for our business. Let's start with a quick review of some of our static pages to give you a sense of how our year closed out. On the first slide, there are two points worth touching on. First, AUM has increased to over $105 billion from $97 billion last quarter and $74 billion last year. The growth in those numbers has been influenced by strength in the stock market, additional client cash flows, and most importantly, alpha generation from our investment teams. We always make sure to put years like 2013 into perspective. In the past 189 years, the stock market has lost more than 30% in a calendar year only three times, and one of those years was 2008. The market has returned over 30% just 26 times, and one of those years was 2013. More than two-thirds of the time, the stock market returns between ±20%. The key takeaway is that we have seen some very unique outcomes from the market over the past 6 years. 2013 was a tail outcome that was beneficial to results, but it was outside the range of normal, and we continued to plan off normalized assumptions. The second point worth touching on is the addition of a sixth investment team. As we noted in earlier press release, we hired Bryan Krug to start a credit team. I will elaborate further about Bryan later in my discussion. Our long-term investment results are illustrated on the next two slides in a consistent manner to past quarters. As of December 31st, 2013, all of our strategies had followed their process with integrity and generated attractive absolute results since inception. Eight of our 11 investment strategies, excluding strategies that launched after December 2008, had added value relative to their broad performance benchmarks over the trailing five-year period and since each strategy's inception. All seven of our investment strategies with a 10-year track record have added value relative to their broad performance benchmarks over the trailing 10 years. Slide four further reinforces the impact of our performance philosophy across our asset base. Our teams run active portfolios with high degrees of investment freedom. Each adheres to a time-tested investment process and executes the same over any market environment. None have a process or incentives that place much value on very short time frames. Therefore, the return patterns of all of our teams will be lumpy. Year over year, this is evident in annual results. More than 90% of our assets under management were in strategies outperforming their respective benchmarks over the trailing 3-year and 10-year periods, and since each strategy's inception. Over the trailing 5-year period, our U.S. mid-cap value strategy, which represents 15% of our assets under management, trailed its benchmark by less than 20 basis points, essentially in line with the market during a robust environment. I will talk about our mid-cap value strategy further in a couple of minutes to elaborate on our process for evaluating investment results. Our mutual fund peer ratings, which are highlighted at the bottom of the page, are a great illustration of how our results translate to long-term peer ratings by Lipper and Morningstar. While on the topic of Morningstar, it is worth pausing for a second to recognize our global value and global equity teams. For the second year in a row, both teams were nominated for Morningstar's 2013 International Stock Fund Manager of the Year in the U.S. In January, Morningstar awarded David Sammer and Dan O'Keefe of the Global Value Team with the award for the second time in 6 years. This is a true testament to the discipline of their process. The first time they won was in the once in 60-plus years down market of 2008, and the second time was in the once in more than 7-plus years up market of 2013. It is the combination of success in the global financial recession of 2008 and bull market of 2013 that has led to the long-term record recognized by Morningstar. As a firm, we have received 9 nominations and 4 awards in the history of our firm. Our U.S. value team and global equity team have also won the award in the domestic stock fund and international stock fund categories, respectively. Slide 5 is a quick outlook at our asset diversification. For the year, 4 of our 5 distribution channels experienced positive flows, led by our broker-dealer channel. Within the institutional channel, we experienced sizable rebalancing that skewed our net flows. 11 of our 13 strategies experienced positive flows, led by our global value and non-U.S. growth strategies. Overall, we think we had a solid diversification across channels and teams. The success of our broker-dealer channel and global value team was meaningful, but only led to a small mix shift in our overall assets. We continue to see positive results from our non-U.S. distribution efforts during 2013 on an absolute basis. Long term, we expect to see more meaningful mix shift as the continued rate of growth of our non-U.S. domiciled clients outpaces our growth in the U.S. Slide 6 highlights 3 core principles that define who we are. This page is the anchor to our beliefs and will anchor our comments each quarter. We are a high value added investment firm designed for investment talent to thrive in a thoughtful growth environment. We believe strongly in the philosophy and approach that define who we are. As I summarize the year and review some of our business accomplishments, you will see how these principles shaped our outcomes. The purpose of the chart on slide 7 is not to argue the definition of a market cycle, because the debate would distract from the points. We have chosen trough to trough or peak to peak as a way to illustrate a cycle for the purpose of highlighting the market cycles vary in length, but generally span 5 to 10 years. While not perfect, we believe this view is more logical than the 3 or 12-month windows that drive standard reporting periods. Time management is a recurring topic for us. We emphasize our business management strategy before highlighting quarterly or yearly outcomes to set expectations. Similar to our investment strategies, we have dedicated resources to set expectations about performance cycles. The importance of these dedicated resources is to buy time. Active management requires long-term thinking. Our business strategy also requires a long-term, normalized view. Too high a level of importance is placed on calendar years and quarters. Business decisions require time to develop a plan, time to communicate a strategy, time to execute properly, and time to measure the execution and success of a decision. In 2013, we accomplished some high-profile business decisions that required years of planning and continued years of execution, such as becoming a public company. Our business decisions don't develop around calendar years. They occur when they are appropriate to achieving our long-term objectives. The addition of our sixth team is a great example of this. We announced the addition of Brian Krug in the fourth quarter. We're spending the first quarter of 2014 establishing operational readiness. We will spend the next 5+ years developing the team's track record and building Brian's team into a franchise. Slide 8 is simply a transition to the discussion. It presents a reminder of our management guideposts and outlines what we think were some of our most notable accomplishments of 2013. I will walk through the investment results, alignment of interest, capacity management, and our talent focus on the 4 pages to follow. Investment results are one of the primary measuring tools for our business success. Our teams run active portfolios with high degrees of investment freedom. As a result, there's an expectation that our teams will produce superior investment returns on an absolute and relative basis over a full market cycle. It is our goal to deliver on those expectations with integrity. Rather than review the results of each strategy, we thought it would be more beneficial to review one strategy in detail relative to the metrics that we take into consideration. Given that I called out our U.S. mid-cap value strategy earlier, I thought I would come back to it. Across the top of the page are the criteria we look at. We want to answer 3 questions. Have we been faithful to a strategy's stated investment philosophy and process? Has the strategy produced good absolute performance? And how does the strategy's performance compare to the performance of its peers, competitors, and the index? In determining the answer to question 1, it is probably easiest to think about our portfolios as conglomerates. With that in mind, we roll up the characteristics of our portfolios relative to the broad market, taking into consideration the tenets of each team's process. In the case of our U.S. value team, we want to see a conglomerate with attractive business economics, attractive cash flow, and a solid balance sheet, trading at an undemanding valuation. We have that when we compare the U.S. mid-cap value strategy relative to a broad mid-cap index. As the team puts it, they seek to build a portfolio that is better, safer, cheaper. The green bars represent rolling 5-year average annualized returns. We could have picked other time frames, but you can see very consistent wealth compounding over time. The gray line represents 5-year rolling excess returns compared to a broad mid-cap index. Over every period presented, but the current one, the team has added value. So how should we think about the current period? It would be inappropriate to take the data on its face. We have to consider the acceleration and momentum of the market over the past 5 years. As I noted earlier, it is outside the range of normal. We would expect a team that emphasizes valuation and business quality would participate strongly, but not lead in that type of environment. Finally, though not represented, we know that this strategy has operated in the top decile of its peer group over the 10-year and since inception time periods. Taken together, these results are process consistent and consistent with expectation. The current period is an outlier. I believe this is also the first 5-year period that Warren Buffett has trailed the S&P over his career. This puts them in good company. Moving to slide 10, the most visible event of 2013 was our IPO. We spent a lot of time leading up to the IPO, not simply planning for it, but discussing the importance of it in the long-term evolution of our business. Equity ownership is critical to our investment culture because it plays a big role in supporting our talent-focused business model. The IPO created a mechanism for broad and multi-generational ownership. It established a structured path to liquidity, and it allows ownership to be shared more broadly among value-producing employees. At its core, our IPO was about ongoing alignment of interests. Our first equity grant, which took place last summer, furthered our goal of interest alignment among our employee owners and with clients and shareholders. Like any business that seeks to grow and thrive, a certain level of reinvestment in core assets is necessary. Our core assets are people, and one of the ways we reinvest in that talent is through rewarding and incentivizing it with equity. We also create alignment through consistency. Bigger dramatic changes from past practices create instability with people, clients, and eventually shareholders. A great workplace provides stability through predictability and our distribution of earnings through dividends extends from that belief. We believe in sharing in the success of our business. Our dividend policy is a consistent extension of that long-held belief. Just last quarter, we spent a fair amount of time talking about capacity management, so I won't spend a lot of time on slide 11 with how fresh the information is. Given the choice of continued short-term asset gathering or long-term protection of alpha, as an investment firm, we will err on maximizing present value and compounding of client wealth above short-term growth rates. With this statement in mind, I just want to hit on one or two quick points, most notably related to our global value strategy, since we just announced a further closing of the strategy about 10 days ago. On the slide, we have illustrated the closing timelines of our U.S. small cap growth and global value strategies. We have purposely excluded asset levels to eliminate the distraction around the points I want to make, because total assets is just one consideration. As we create capacity for growth, we have to ensure we are managing that capacity appropriately. We are an investment firm first and foremost. That means that as we grow, we need to protect alpha potential. Protecting alpha means understanding the impact of total assets, number of clients, distribution mix, and velocity of assets on the investment process. It also requires market contact and other non-typical variables. The evolution of our U.S. small cap growth strategy was impacted by asset size and asset velocity, but it was also impacted by a huge market decline, team integration, and ultimately a huge market recovery. The result was multiple closing decisions and reopening. Every strategy is unique when we consider closing. The further closing of global value strategy extends from its own path. Last year, we closed a new separate account business to better manage asset growth and diversification. Asset velocity has continued as performance surged through 2013. The result has been a growing imbalance between cash and investable ideas. The parameters of the strategy may allow for additional assets, but the confluence of events demands we restrict further growth to protect the alpha potential over the long term. Investment results, our capital structure, and our capacity development decisions can tend to be some of our most visible accomplishments. But our talent focus, highlighted on slide 12, is the one that we believe is the primary driver for our business. 2013 was a great year in that regard. Our global equity team promoted Charles Hamker and Andrew Uretig to additional decision-making responsibilities during the year. It established a new global small-cap growth strategy, which is a natural extension of the team's research, and through the launch created additional depth in decision-making with the promotion of Dave Geisler to co-portfolio manager for this strategy. These were great strides in the breadth of decision-making and creation of natural succession options. Our growth team expanded the roles of Matt Tam and Craig Sepikanis to portfolio managers on all of its strategies and formalized the lead portfolio manager role on its team. The team now has incredible decision-making breadth and a highly fluid research and portfolio management process that positions the team very well for years to come. The U.S. value team promoted Dan Kane to portfolio manager across all of its strategies, joining Scott, Jim, and George. It also announced the retirement of Scott Satterwhite, which is planned for 2016, which is a great illustration of the glacial transition and succession plan we envision. Finally, we hired Brian Krug to build our sixth autonomous investment team. The right talent for Artisan is a scarce resource and should not be forced. Similar to the institutional decision-making process, our talent development and recruitment process is a gradual one. Like investing, one very bad decision can more than offset multiple good decisions. So we meet with a lot of teams and only move forward when we are fully confident. We are very confident that Brian is the right person to lead to the build-out of a credit franchise at our firm. Brian has the characteristics we look for in an investor. He is passionate about investing. He is a creative thinker. He has a disciplined approach. He is a great fit within our business model and culture. And his product is one that aligns well with our institutional focus. We are working with him over his first few months here to build his team, establish an office, and develop the infrastructure, research, and trading platforms he will need to execute his strategy. We will talk more about his strategy during our first quarter update. As I wrap up, I want to touch on a few quick items about our expectations for 2014. I began this update talking about the time business decisions require, time to develop a plan, time to communicate a strategy, time to execute properly, and time to measure the execution and success of a decision. As I look forward to 2014, we are going to continue to do things gradually. 2013 was a big year for our firm in a lot of ways. We don't want to lose sight of doing things the right way. We believe that patience is a virtue and protects against bad decisions. If the market finds this uninteresting, we are fine with boring. We are going to continue to manage capacity with prudence. We have illustrated that through the further closing of our global value strategy. We will continue to develop new business in a way that matches our high value-added philosophy by not compromising on portfolio structure or fees. We will pursue markets globally that provide leverage to our business model. Our onboarding of Brian will incorporate some early introductions and asset gathering, but will settle into a focus around his portfolio. We will solidify the research and operational items he needs to be successful. We want his time focused on investing. As I said last quarter, we view ourselves as a growth firm, and we are committed to growth over the long term, but our commitment is to thoughtful growth. With that business perspective, I will pass the lead to CJ for a financial update.
Thanks, Eric. Welcome, everyone. I will begin on slide 13, which is a review of our fourth quarter and full calendar year December 2013 results. In summary, we ended the year with another solid quarter. AUM increased to $105.5 billion, and net client cash inflows were $1.5 billion. Revenues were $197.6 million, up 11% over revenues in the preceding September 2013 quarter, and up 44% over the December 2012 quarter. Our adjusted operating margin declined slightly to 42.9% after factoring in strong AUM growth, offset by a full quarter of expense related to our first public company employee equity grant in July and costs associated with starting our sixth investment team. Net income per share on an adjusted basis was 77 cents per share compared to 67 cents per share in the September 2013 quarter. Yesterday, our board of directors declared an increased quarterly dividend of 55 cents per share, up from 43 cents per share, as well as a special annual dividend of $1.63 per share. Combined, Class A common shareholders will receive $2.18 per share as a dividend. On a GAAP basis, as a result of IPO-related charges, which we have previously discussed, as well as the GAAP effects on our EPS calculation of the follow-on offering conducted in November, we recorded a GAAP loss per share of $1.42 for the quarter and a GAAP loss of 63 cents per share for the year. This GAAP loss per share occurred because the market price per share of the common stock sold in our November follow-on offering exceeded the per share carrying value of the convertible preferred shares we repurchased with a portion of the offering proceeds. On an adjusted basis, we reported earnings per share of 77 cents for the quarter and $2.54 for the year. The adjusted earnings measures reported in our earnings release remove the accounting impact of certain transactions related to our initial public offering and the November follow-on offering. These non-GAAP measures provide investors with the same financial metrics that we, as management, use to manage the company. Slide 14 is a review of our AUM for the quarter and year 2013. Ending AUM of $105.5 billion were up 9% from assets of $96.9 billion at September 30, 2013, and up 42% from assets a year ago. Average assets for the December quarter were $101.0 billion, up 9% from average assets in the September 2013 quarter. The increase in AUM during the December quarter was due to $1.5 billion of net client cash inflows, which equates to a 1.5% organic growth rate for the quarter and a 6% annualized rate, as well as 7% of market appreciation, including alpha generation. Included in client cash flows for the December quarter were outflows of approximately $500 million related to the Artisan Fund's annual income and capital gains distributions net of reinvestments. The level of cash that clients chose to retain and not reinvest in this year's distribution was not unusual in terms of percentages, but was significantly more in dollar terms as a result of the increased size of the distribution. For the year ended December 31, 2013, net client cash inflows were $7.2 billion, a 10% annualized organic growth rate. Market appreciation, including alpha generation, added another $24 billion, or 32% of AUM growth. While pleased with the strength of flows this year, we continue to be equally pleased with the quality of our growth, as seen through the diversification of our client cash flows in the U.S. and abroad, as well as across our vehicles, channels, and investment teams. As Eric previously discussed, we just recently announced that we are further closing our global value strategies, which have been a meaningful source of our growth over the past 2 years. Throughout our history, our growth has been lumpy and has come from certain strategies and teams during distinct pockets of time. We close strategies to preserve alpha creation because we put the interests of our clients first and value growth through alpha creation over growth from new client inflows. The closing of our global value strategies is an example of this. Looking ahead, we see encouraging interest in our non-U.S. growth and global opportunity strategies that we expect will provide our future growth. On slide 15, you will see that our non-U.S. client AUM ended the fourth quarter at $11.9 billion, up $1 billion from last quarter, and up 51% from $7.9 billion a year ago. Our non-U.S. flows were flat this quarter, but for the full year were $1.3 billion and represented 18% of our overall flows. As a result, our non-U.S. organic growth rate was 17% for 2013. We are seeing increased investor interest overseas, and our pipeline of opportunities outside the U.S. is strong. Financial results begin on slide 16. For the December 2013 quarter, revenues were $197.6 million on average AUM of $101 billion. That's an increase in revenues of 11% over September quarter and a 44% increase from the corresponding December quarter in 2012. The December 2013 quarter included $2.5 million of annual performance fees earned and measured at December 31, 2013. For the year ended December 2013, revenues were $685.8 million on average AUM of $89.5 billion. That's up 36% from revenues of $505.6 million in the corresponding fiscal year ended December 31, 2012. The weighted average management fee for the current quarter rounded up to 78 basis points as a result of the annual performance fee earned in the quarter. For the year, our average management fee rounded up to 77 basis points. Slide 17, our adjusted operating margin, which excludes pre-offering share-based compensation expense, was 42.9% for the current quarter, compared to 43.3% in the September 2013 quarter and 40.4% in the corresponding fourth quarter of 2012. The slight downtick from September was the result of a full quarter of equity-based compensation expense and initial onboarding costs related to the build-out of our newest investment team. Beginning in the March quarter, we will begin to layer in additional operating costs associated with starting the new team, including the hiring of additional investment and operational professionals, as well as related occupancy and technology costs. We expect that total incremental net expenses related to the team will be in the $6 to $7 million range in calendar 2014. That assumes a very modest amount of asset raise in the year, which may be conservative. While excluded from our non-GAAP earnings, last quarter we began the process of obtaining the necessary client approvals in connection with the change of control for purposes of the Investment Company and Investment Advisors Act that will occur in March 2014. That process is almost complete, and during the December quarter, we incurred $2.6 million of costs related to those efforts. The March 2014 quarter will include some additional costs, which we expect will be immaterial as we wind up the process. Adjusted net income for the December quarter was $55 million, or 77 cents per adjusted share. That's a 16% increase in adjusted net income over the prior September quarter and a 62% increase over the prior December 2012 quarter. Included in adjusted net income from the December 2013 quarter is a non-operating gain of $5.1 million. This gain resulted from the sale of investment securities held in connection with the pre-IPO retention award for the investment team members, which concluded on December 31, 2013. The expense related to that award was tied to the market value of these investments. After considering the related expense for the quarter, the effect on net income was $1.3 million, or approximately 2 cents per share. In comparison, the September quarter included expenses related to that arrangement that resulted in 3 cent negative impact to adjusted net income per adjusted share. For the year ended December 31, 2013, our adjusted operating margin was 42.1%, an increase from 40.1% in the prior year, and adjusted earnings per adjusted share was $2.54. Slide 18 highlights our comp ratio. As you know, our comp expense continues to include noise related to pre-IPO related compensation and the cash retention award we granted 3 years ago. We've broken out those components so you can see the ongoing expenses with equity-based comp layered in and excluding the pre-IPO and retention costs. We continue to believe that as we layer in the full effects of post-IPO equity-based comp awards, which generally vest over 5 years, and excluding the pre-IPO expenses, our compensation ratio will settle in the mid-40s. As a reminder, our compensation ratio will and can fluctuate and will be impacted by our rate of growth and the cost of future equity-based awards, which is largely dependent upon the size of future grants and our stock price at the time of the grant. The last slide is our balance sheet highlights. Our balance sheet remains strong. Cash on the balance sheet remains healthy and grew throughout the year, ending at $212 million. Our debt levels remained at $200 million, and our credit ratios are strong, with leverage at 0.7 times EBITDA. In connection with the November 2013 follow-on offering, the contingent value right liability of $15 million in September 2013 was extinguished. Lastly, our board of directors declared a quarterly dividend of 55 cents per Class A common stock and a special annual dividend of $1.63 per share. Both dividends, a total of $2.18 per share, will be paid on February 28th to shareholders of record as of the close of business on February 14th. Our dividend policy targets the distribution of the majority of our annual adjusted earnings through a quarterly dividend, and subject to firm profitability and business conditions, a special annual dividend. This initial special annual dividend reflects strong earnings in 2013 and excess cash on the balance sheet. I do not expect that next year's special dividend will include a distribution of excess cash, and therefore will likely be lower than this initial special annual dividend, other things remaining equal. I look forward to your questions, and we'll now turn it back to Eric.
TJ, I thank you for your time and patience. It is important to understand our business before evaluating the outcomes. To provide additional clarity, we will open the call for questions.
Thank you. We will now begin the question and answer session. To ask a question, you may press star then one on your touch-tone phone. If you are using a speakerphone, please pick up your handset before pressing the keys. To withdraw your question, please press star and then two. At this time, we'll pause momentarily to assemble our roster. And our first question comes from Bill Katz of Citigroup. Please go ahead.
Okay, thank you. Good morning. I appreciate the thorough update. Could you talk a little bit about your policy for a dividend payout for 2014? think the fourth quarter extra payment this year, or the extra payment, I should say, was significantly above everyone's expectations, a little bit higher than your sort of earnings run rate. Maybe just an update on how you're thinking about sort of cash flow this year?
Yeah, sure. Hey, Bill, it's CJ. You know, our expectation is, you know, we increased the quarterly dividend to 55 cents. We'll pay that, you know, through the October quarter, and then consider, you know, a revision to the quarterly in next January, early February. And then and we expect through that quarterly that we would distribute, you know, more than half of our earnings, and then distribute the remaining with the special annual. Approximately half of the special annual this year was the result of earnings, and half was the result of excess cash, which is probably what you're trying to get to.
Right. So we should be thinking 100% of free cash flow goes for dividend this year?
Between the quarterly and the special annual, yes. We're anticipating most, if not all, of the annual earnings.
Okay, that's very helpful. And then as I looked through the supplement, I spent a moment on the breakdown between U.S. and non-U.S. sales. And Eric, I think you mentioned there was some rebalancing during the year. Could you talk a little bit about what kind of demand you're seeing outside the United States as it relates to net sales?
Yeah, certainly. The demand outside the U.S. is in primarily institutional for us. So you see a lumpier pattern there. With regards to specific strategies, we see interest in our global equity strategy, our global opportunities, and we saw last year the global value strategy pick up assets as well. You know, we've been much, I think, more consistent in the U.S. than the intermediary channel over the last four quarters. But when we look at our opportunity set and demand, there's clearly a higher demand outside the U.S. It'll just be, I think, lumpy, which is pretty consistent with the institutional channel.
Okay, just one last one for me. Thank you for taking all my questions. As you think about the new team you're bringing on board on for high yield, in the past, what's been sort of the upslope for asset gathering in some of the other groups, just to try and sort of frame what the flow opportunity might be for there? And then against that, CJ, you mentioned you gave some guidance for expenses this year. Would that be subject to an increase to the extent that you would beat those AUM expectations?
Yeah, Bill, I'll take the first part of your question, and I'll turn it over to CJ there. You know, new teams that we've brought on, or even new strategies that we've launched, we've had fairly low expectations with regards to asset buildup. Our primary focus is on making sure that we find the right people to put on the team with Brian, and also have the proper infrastructure so that over the short run we can build the right foundation to the high-yield strategy, and then hopefully over the next 3 to 5 years really turn it into a key franchise into the firm. In past years, you know, the assets have really ranged you know, from $100 million to a few $100 million in flows, and they're very hard to predict. So we're being awfully conservative on it, and having low expectations on asset flows. We're more focused on the team and the build out of the strategy.
And so on the cost, Bill, we would not expect to see a material increase in costs depending on the asset raise. We think we have a sort of a fully baked initial startup cost going in. I did mention that we also experienced some costs in the fourth quarter as we began the onboarding of the team and building it out, and that impacted margin negatively by a little less than 1%.
Okay, that's very helpful. Thank you for taking all my questions.
No problem.
Our next question is from Robert Lee of KBW. Please go ahead.
Great. Thanks. Good morning, guys. Curious, I mean, in the global value strategy, is it possible to size how much of that or your business comes from platforms where existing investors can still contribute money? I don't know if that, you know, I guess that mainly be kind of a DC kind of platform. Is that a significant or meaningful contributor to new sales with that strategy?
Yeah, Rob, I think your question around you broke up a little bit on me, but the question around the global value strategy and once closed, what type of reoccurring dollars could flow into the strategy? The strategy has a pretty balanced mix of assets between institutional and the intermediary channel. The intermediary channel will be a source of some ongoing flows, but we've managed those relationships so that we wouldn't expect any large or unexpected flows. So I would have lower expectations around dollars coming in that closed strategy.
Okay, great. And CJ, and I apologize, I think I probably missed some of these comments, but the little modeling question, but the gain in the quarter, did you suggest that came from some investment gains related to deferred comp, so there's some other expense offset? I just want to make sure I understood that correctly.
Yeah, the net impact was the $1.3 million. We had the $5 million gain was the realized gain because we actually liquidated the investment security that we had funded to fund that deferred comp plan in the quarter because that ended that arrangement ended December 31, 2013.
Okay, great. And one last question on the emerging market strategy. If I remember correctly, outside of the one large redemption about a year ago, I guess it was, that business has been relatively stable from a flow perspective. But I think recently you'd suggested that you've been seeing some, at least prior to the last month or so, been seeing some continued interest in that strategy. Just trying to get a feel for how you see investors, institutional investors, kind of reacting to some of the recent sell-off and turmoil. Do you get a sense that they're kind of reassessing their allocations to emerging markets one way or another, or is that at all impacting kind of the dialogues you're having around the emerging markets or other strategies?
I mean, certainly we've seen a lot of flows over the last 3 years go into the emerging markets category. And you've seen it both in the active and the passive categories. So there's been strong interest in the space. I think the fall off in returns compared to the developed markets has certainly slowed the flow there, and people reassessing their mix of style as well as active and passive. So there's been a slowdown in that that category, and with our strategy specifically, we've been challenged on performance over the last few years, so you've seen a loss, which you mentioned a year ago. Over the last year, we've been fairly stable on flows, but overall, we haven't seen much interest in the strategy. It's been primarily in our global equity strategies, which has the ability to invest in emerging markets. And that's where we see some of our clients getting exposure, is allowing us to make those allocations within a broader and higher degrees of freedom in those strategies.
Great. Thanks for taking my question.
Our next question is from Michael Kim of Sandler O'Neill. Please go ahead.
Hey, guys. Good morning. Up until at least more recently, it did seem like retail investors were getting more comfortable taking on more risk in terms of their asset allocation. So assuming that dynamic continues to play out, just curious to get your thoughts on where you see opportunities to continue to gain market share and how that might influence flow trends across the different investment teams.
Yes. Hey, Michael, it's Eric. Yeah, as you know, our retail assets under management is, under 10%, so it's not a meaningful part when you look at our other channels with regards to the intermediary and the institutional. But we are, seeing, interest in the intermediary. We saw that last year in the flows of the intermediary channel, specifically the broker-dealer channel. Our preference is clearly looking for an institutionally oriented process embedded in the intermediary because we think that extends the duration of assets. And within the high net worth, broker-dealer, intermediary, whatever you want to define it there, which I think it does pick up that retail trend, we are seeing, a definite flow into active equity strategies. And the strategies have been pretty broad-based when you look, especially last quarter, when we look at the assets that came into Artisan, it was a very healthy diversification across multiple teams.
Okay, and then maybe just focusing on the institutional side of the business. Now that some pension plans are closer to being fully funded following the rally in equities, it sounds like some of them may be adopting a bit more of a defensive stance to immunize liabilities to a greater degree. You mentioned some ongoing rebalancing that impacted your separate account flows in the fourth quarter. So just wondering to what extent that might that trend might further narrow growth opportunities for institutional equities more broadly.
Yeah, we've definitely, as you highlighted, the trend towards immunizing plans or some type of liability matching within the institutional channel has been in existence over the last 3-4 years, certainly with the strong equity returns last year. A lot of plans have become close to fully funded. And if you layer on top our performance for the year on top of a robust equity market, I mean, we were, at least 450 basis points as a firm across our weighted index. So a lot of our clients were rebalancing in the strength. So we saw muted results in the institutional marketplace. Fortunately, there's a large asset base there in that institutional marketplace, and there's always opportunities for growth. Pending, our competitors and how they perform and how the index performs. So while the growth, is, probably somewhere around 2-3% in that traditional institutional defined benefit, probably a little bit better in the endowment channel, we can still see good growth rate given the size of assets there for our strategies. But there's clearly a headwind out there.
Okay, that's it for me. Thanks.
Our next question is from Mark Irizarry of Goldman Sachs. Please go ahead.
Oh, great. Thanks. Eric, can we just staying on the topic of rebalancing and the headwind that you face. If you think about your business and your strategy to bring new teams in, where are these assets going, and is there a, sort of imperative over time that, suggests that, you need to sort of build out teams that can help you maybe capture more of the asset allocation, and if so, where, what would be some of those strategies that, that may be able to sort of help you, as investors think about rebalancing or moving across asset allocations that might help you sort of capture some of that share?
Yeah, sure, Mark. In the institutional space, that rebalancing, I think we saw dollars flow out into the alternative space, and we saw rebalancing within the fixed income space into more specialized, higher degree of freedom strategies. And we clearly have picked up a great opportunity with Brian Krug with the credit team to be able to pick up assets that get rebalanced in the fixed income. And we have a very strong interest looking at the alternative space of various hedge fund strategies that could fit into the Artisan model. So those are two areas that we would look to for growth.
Okay, great. And then just on the on the closing of of your strategy, the global value. I guess if we look at the fourth quarter trends, is some of the activity sort of pulled forward? Is there sort of anticipated that those strategies where the channel sort of know it's going to close, and therefore was there some activity that was pulled forward, perhaps?
There was no anticipation on the strategy closing. You do have a little bit of a tail to closing because, you announce your closing, you have to work with the intermediary channel on closing the spigots within each of those platforms. And then secondly, we also create a grandfather list for the institutional and separate accounts so that we're not pulling out midstream of a finals or some other RFP process there. So the front end, there's no anticipation of it, but the back end has a little bit of a tail to it. So it does take a little while in the closing process.
Okay, and then just in terms of first quarter, I know it's somewhat early, but obviously it's been there's been some volatility. Can you give some perspective on the maybe the pipeline of institutional money, what you're seeing, what you're currently seeing, and how we should sort of expect the what we should sort of expect in terms of institutional wins that maybe are in the pipeline or sort of maybe redemptions that we can expect go forward?
Yeah, our pipeline has been fairly consistent and it remains skewed outside the U.S., which I think CJ alluded to in his comments earlier. Overall, the pipelines are always difficult to get too specific on or be that accurate. So I think the best thing is that it seems fairly consistent quarter over quarter, and it's been that way probably the bulk of last year, and going into this year seems healthy.
Okay, and then first quarter to date flows, is there some some seasonality that we should expect in 1Q for you guys?
I don't think we're seeing anything abnormal quarter over this quarter relative to the first quarter last year.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Our next question is from Cynthia Mayer of Bank of America. Please go ahead.
Hi, thanks a lot. Just to clarify maybe on the $6 to $7 million that you expect associated with the new team, how much of that, I guess, what was the cost of the new team exactly in 4Q, and is the $6 to $7 million on top of that, or should we think of it as sort of the entire cost?
Yes, so in the fourth quarter we did incur some expenses as we started to bring on the new team and started the process of building out the infrastructure. And so we would expect to see typically, about the same amount levels of expenses, and the $6 to $7 million was really related to next year. So, obviously that's, if it occurs evenly over the year, that's about $1.5 to $2 million a quarter.
Okay, I see. So it's not on top of the 4Q, and maybe the 4Q.
No, it's not on top of
that. Right. Okay, and then with the new franchise that you guys are building out, so it's credit, which typically has lower fees. So what kind of fee rate are you anticipating, and are you at all, does it matter to you particularly if the fee rate was, as those assets built, if the fee rate was a little bit lower and had an impact on the overall fee rate?
Yes, Cynthia, it's Eric. Certainly we've analyzed the high yield space, and we think the fee rates are in line to some of our other strategies, more specifically some of the large cap value or global equity strategies there. Starting off with the credit strategy and the high yield space, it will be capacity constrained, and we'll manage those flows and we'll manage our fee rates. So I think you'll see a slightly lower fee than our weighted average in the firm, which is 77 basis points, but we're not expecting a meaningful impact on lowering the overall fee within the firm. And that also is going to be, you know, skewed towards an emphasis on using pooled vehicles for the new strategy.
You mean you want to emphasize funds as you begin to sell it?
Yes.
Okay. And I guess last thing is you mentioned strategies, plural. So over time, am I right, you sort of expect this team to develop a few different credit strategies?
Yeah, we would expect when we bring a team on that over time that we would have multiple strategies and hopefully develop multiple decision makers and, you know, match our definition of a true franchise. We'll stay focused on the one strategy we have in mind right now, which we hope to launch in the next few months. And then where appropriate, we'll lay in other strategies. We have no definitive strategy. It would be the number two strategy within this franchise. But over the long term, we clearly would see more than one strategy.
Great. All right, that's it for me. Thanks a lot.
Thanks.
As a reminder, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star and then one. And our next question is from Chris Shuttler of William Blair. Please go ahead.
Hey, guys. Good morning. CJ, you mentioned good momentum in the non-U.S. growth and global opportunity strategies, which makes sense. So on non-U.S. growth, you're at $25 billion of AUM as of 12/31. You know, obviously that strategy has been over $30 billion in the past. So as you think about capacity there, assuming velocity of new money remains reasonable and you are finding opportunities to invest, and is it fair to think that strategy could get materially over $30 billion at some point in time?
Hey, Chris, it's Eric. I'm just going to jump in here on this one. The strategy overall is a growth-oriented strategy that tends to be into the larger cap blue chip names. We have been over $30 billion in a strategy with, you know, room for growth there on top of it. I don't know how much, you know, meaningfully over that we will be, but certainly when we look at the $24, $25 billion exact, I'm not sure the exact number on that non-U.S. growth strategy, we have good room for growth there. But we don't have a definitive number in mind. And at this point, as we experience some velocity or experience, you know, any strain on the integrity of the strategy, it will certainly come into discussion.
Okay, makes sense. Thanks, Eric. And then in the global equity strategy, obviously you've had a PM change there, I think, about a year ago. But, you know, performance is terrific. You have a three-year track record. Just curious, you know, what the conversations are like right now with the consultants and what the pipeline looks like, because you would think that you guys could start seeing some more meaningful flows there at some point in time.
I think overall we're getting improved traction with the PM change being a little over a year ago now, and the promotion of Charles Hamker and Andrew Reddick on the team has created great depth and created comfort in the marketplace. And then you layer the performance has been exceptional. And overall, when you look at the strategy of the global equity versus, say, the international equity or the international small cap, there's been great consistency to the overall characteristics. So we have high expectations for that strategy, picking up in the institutional channel as well as potentially the intermediary overseas. I think we're very well positioned there.
Okay. I mean, do you feel like you need the 5-year, or is 3-year plenty?
In the more mature strategies, like a large cap equity and global equities, at 3-4 years, you're starting to get some good interest. At 5 years is when you see more of a hockey stick that could start occurring. say, versus a small cap strategy. The global small cap strategy, you know, will need a shorter time period. But I think we're in a really good spot to start, you know, building a foundation of consultants following it and clients coming into the strategy. So I wouldn't expect as high as growth as you might see in, you know, the global ops or the international equity. But I think it will get on the radar this year.
All right, great. Thanks a lot.
Our next question is a follow-up from Bill Katz of Citigroup. Please go ahead.
Okay, thank you. I actually have two follow-ups. CJ, I'm sorry, I was just multitasking a little bit. As I think about the incremental $6 to $7 million of expenses, did you mention before that the fourth quarter had a couple million already in there? So I guess the question is it a step up from here, or is it flat, all else being equal? And I have a follow-up.
Pretty much flat, all else being equal. We had some initial onboarding costs, and then we started the implementation of the strategy. So we would expect it to be a similar cost, assuming, you know, we spend equally over the four quarters.
Right. Okay, and then with the closing of the Global Value Fund, is there any sort of surge we should anticipate, surge might be too strong of a term, pick up of volume just in front of the hard close that might hit in January and or February?
No, I wouldn't expect a major surge there. We've closed multiple strategies, and I think the first time we probably closed a strategy or 2 years ago. You saw surges are running, you know, to get in before the door closes. We've managed that so that we, you know, we wouldn't expect that strong push coming into the strategy. So I wouldn't expect it.
Okay. Thank you so much for the extra questions.
Sure.
And our next question is a follow-up from Cynthia Mayer, Bank of America. Please go ahead.
Hi. Sorry to circle back once more on expenses. So just a couple of things. One is the severance expense that was in this last year should no longer be in for 2014, right? Wasn't that a one-year event?
That's correct.
Okay. And the on the G&A, a lot of the rise in the fourth quarter was, I think, the proxy expense. Is that right? So that would not be in first quarter. So all else equal, it would go down.
That's correct. We do adjust. Yeah, it was $2.6 million. We do adjust that in our adjusted earnings per adjusted share. We also had a slight uptick in T&E as we traveled around the world on the distribution side primarily, and then also on the technology side. You know, I've been talking about some uptick in expense there, and we saw that in the fourth quarter as well.
Okay, and the mid-40s comp to revenues ratio that will eventually you guys will eventually build up to, is that inclusive of the $6 to $7 million cost, or is that, you know, apart from that?
Yes, that reflects our forecast, including all expenses that we know of today and anticipate.
Oh, okay, so then once your build-up is done, in fact, your comp-to-revenues ratio should begin to back off a little bit from that, right?
Well, I mean, the major driver there is going to really be the layering in of our equity-based comp expenses, as a public company. Offsetting that from a margin perspective is growth.
Right, so it would really probably be a function of the revenues in the end after the comp is built in. All right. Sure. Thanks a lot.
Mm-hmm. You're welcome.
And this concludes our question and answer session. I'd like to turn the conference back over to Mr. Colson for any closing remarks.
Great. Thank you very much, and this concludes the call. Thanks.
The conference is now concluded. Thank you for attending today's presentation. You may now disconnect.